So I picture Ricky Henderson edging off the first base bag, taking his lead and then extending it, stealthily, little by little, his watchful eyes fixed on the pitcher, larceny in his heart. Would Henderson have stolen more bases than any player in Major League history if he were afraid to risk being thrown out? How about Babe Ruth? Would he have hit 714 home runs if he feared striking out, which he did 1,330 times? The answer, obviously, is no. And yet the fear of failure, more than any single thing, keeps people in sports and in all avenues of life from realizing their full potential. Fear of failure prevents more of us from succeeding than any opponent. Fear creates the conditions that keep athletes from winning. Fear of failure can restrict a player, said Chuck Knoll, the former Pittsburgh Steelers coach. It can kill him as an individual. If one continually worries about failing, he'll get so tight that he will fail. One of the paradoxes of sports is that fear of failure actually makes failure more likely. As Knoll said, the thought of negative consequences threatens you, inhibits you, and tightens you up. Fear of failure leads to contracted muscles and shortened breathing. It overloads the system with stress. Fear makes you play safe. Fear makes you play small. Here's an interesting experiment. Take someone with a strong fear of failure. Give the person several wadded sheets of paper and ask him or her to toss them into a wastebasket from three different spots, directly over the basket, from 15 feet away, and from 40 feet away. Studies have shown that those who fear failure will feel most anxious from 15 feet. Standing over the basket, they know success is guaranteed. From 40 feet away, they have no expectations to succeed. From 15 feet, they feel they should be able to toss the paper ball into the basket, but they know there is a chance they may fail. You also see this in golf. Facing an impossible 40-foot putt, a golfer is more relaxed than when he stands over a dreaded 4-footer. Why? Because the player is afraid to fail. When you're not afraid to fail, your chances of succeeding improve. Where does this fear come from? Oftentimes, behind the fear of failure is perfectionism. I think perfectionism is reinforced in society. In school, from an early age, we are told what we got wrong on a test instead of what we got right. When I was in graduate school, I told my counselor I was a perfectionist. "Oh, yeah?" the counselor replied. "Tell me, Gary, what are you perfect at?" Do you know how gemologists tell a fake emerald from a real one? The fakes are perfect. Real emeralds have flaws. None of us is perfect. Oftentimes, beneath the desire to succeed and achieve excellence is an ultra-critical, demanding, and judgmental voice. This internal voice beats the person up, mentally and emotionally. We learned this from pitcher Sean Estes, who realized he was an impatient perfectionist. When Rick Wolf worked with the Cleveland Indians, he wrote an article about the perfect pitch syndrome. An example of this condition is a successful AAA pitcher who is called up to the major leagues. Instead of trusting his stuff, the pitcher thinks he has to be perfect against big league hitting. So he tries to nibble on the corners of the plate. Because he is new to the big show, umpires don't give him the close pitches. The harder the pitcher tries to paint the corners, the farther behind in the count he falls. The more he gets behind in the count, the greater the hitter's advantage becomes. When the first pitch is a strike, the major league batting average is below 200. If the first pitch is a ball, the batting average jumps to more than 300. Procrastination is a part of perfectionism in some people. Those who procrastinate don't do anything. By not doing anything, they can't fail. It's an inhibiting, self-defeating cycle. Fear keeps people from taking risks, and sometimes the greatest risk is not to take a risk. If Jerry Colangelo were afraid of failure, one of sport's most successful businessmen might not have left the Hungry Hill neighborhood of Chicago where he grew up, or played basketball at the University of Illinois, or moved to the desert southwest to run the new NBA team, the Phoenix Suns. If Colangelo hadn't been willing to take a risk, there wouldn't be an America West Arena in downtown Phoenix, and Arizona might not have a Major League Baseball team. Tennis great Billie Jean King made a profound statement about failure. She said athletes should look at failure as feedback. All-star pitcher Greg Maddux put it another way. Failure is the best teacher in the world. You get to learn from what happens to you, both good and bad, in a real live game situation. I've given up a lot of runs in my career, and that means I've made a lot of mistakes, and I've had to learn from them. The hitters have a funny way of telling you that a particular pitch isn't working. Failing to learn is learning to fail. By looking at failure as feedback, you can change how you feel. Michael Jordan calls fear an illusion. He and many other great athletes learn to turn fear into anger. You can run from fear, or you can get angry and attack it. If you challenged Jordan's pride, he wouldn't be afraid. He used that energy to become more aggressive. Good athletes take fear of failure and turn it around. Look at fear as a natural part of growing and learning. People who succeed aren't afraid to fail. Failure can be a better teacher than winning. Learn how to fail successfully. Hate to fail, but never fear it. Learn to view failure as feedback. Permission to win. You can't outperform your self-image. Dennis Conner. Life is a collection of self-fulfilling prophecies. John Neighbor. Before the tournament began, few gave him a chance to contend, much less win. Jan Vandeveld was a 150-1 underdog. But to the amazement of the golf world and Scottish bookmakers, there he was on Sunday, standing on the tee of the 72nd hole at Carnoustie, leading the 1999 British Open by 3 shots. One hole to go. All Vandeveld had to do was make 6 at number 18. A double bogey, and golf's oldest prize was his. The soft voice of reason told the dashing Frenchman to do the smart thing, play conservatively, hit a 5-iron off the tee, then another 5-iron, then a wedge to the green. 2 putts later, and Vandeveld could kiss his wife and lift the claret jug in celebration as the first Frenchman to win a major golf championship in 92 years. But Vandeveld didn't play it safe. In the gathering gloom, a light rain falling, he hit his driver. The ball sailed wildly offline. Instead of wedging his next shot back onto the fairway, Vandeveld took a full swing with a 2-iron. The ball bounced off the grandstands and disappeared into the rough. His next shot was from a terrible lie and landed in the winding creek that fronts the green. The world cringed as it watched him single-handedly turn the Open into a stage play as compelling and wrenching as Les Miserables. Vandeveld didn't make 6. He made 7 and then lost in a playoff. When the nightmare was over, witnesses asked the same head-shaking question. Jean, why didn't you play it safe? Why hit a 2-iron? The runner-up gave a little shrug. Next time I hit the wedge, Vandeveld said, pasting on a brave smile. You'll say I'm a coward, but I'll hit the wedge. Why didn't he? Because that's not the way Vandeveld saw himself. Even though a timid shot might have assured him victory, he played the hole boldly and fearlessly. He had to play that way, his wife Brigitte said. He had played that way all week. Vandeveld was being true to his self-image. The golfer's collapse made one Scottish bookmaker look like a prophet. "The lead doesn't matter," he said before Vandeveld's final round. The bookie tapped the side of his head with a finger. The gesture seemed to suggest he had little faith the leader would hold up under the pressure. Vandeveld, who had won only one tournament on the European Tour, was out of his comfort zone. There is a psychological principle called cognitive dissonance. It can be defined as the uncomfortable psychological state that arises when how you see yourself and what is really happening come into conflict. Many athletes who experience this conflict revert to their comfort zone. "We all have an interior comfort zone that we want to be in," said Dennis Conner, the America's Cup skipper. Picture a good club golfer playing Jack Nicklaus. His self-image is probably that he is a good golfer, but not good enough to beat Nicklaus. If he beat Nicklaus, he would be uncomfortable with the demands of his new self-image. So he does whatever he can to get back in that comfort zone, even if it means missing a 2-foot putt on the 18th green. Annika Sorenstam is a case in point. In an interview, the LPGA champion said that early in her career, she was afraid of having to speak in public and felt so uncomfortable being the center of attention that she would deliberately miss putts on the later holes in tournaments just so she could finish second. She had a fear of success, which is fear of failure at the next level. "I love golf. I learned to play when I moved to Arizona. One day I was at my home course, on the 11th or 12th hole, when a partner told me, 'Gary, you know you're shooting even par?' I'm a 10 handicapper. My image of myself is not that of a par golfer. As soon as I heard the words, 'You're shooting par,' I felt such a pressure on myself that I pushed my next tee shot out of bounds. Triple bogey. After that, I relaxed again. I was back in my comfort zone." There are a lot of comfort zone athletes. I see many of them in AAA baseball. During the last off season, I worked with a pitcher who has one of the liveliest arms in the game. In AAA, he is a dominating force. But every time he is placed in a major league situation, he falls apart. He can't see himself getting major leaguers out. The Arizona Cardinals once drafted a wonderfully gifted running back. He was as big and strong as any back in the NFL. But he couldn't see himself as a starter. He couldn't even imagine himself being successful. His self-image wouldn't let him. Therefore, he wasn't in professional football for long. Limits begin where vision ends. You have to see yourself as a no-limits person. For years, breaking the 4-minute mile was thought to be physically impossible. Then, in 1954, Roger Bannister ran the mile in 3 minutes 59.4 seconds. Over the next 2 years, 50 other runners broke the barrier. Why? They had an image. In Bannister, they had a model for success. Dennis Eckersley saw himself as a starting pitcher. Only when he reinvented his self-image and saw himself as a closer did he become a premier reliever. Recently, retired Cubs announcer Steve Stone, a former major league pitcher, talks about reprogramming your subconscious mind. "It's like wiping a blackboard clean and starting over," Stone said. "The spring before I won the Cy Young Award, I had to sit down and convince myself that I was better than a 500 pitcher." Humans are the only species that get in the way of their own growth. The most important thing a parent can give a child is a positive self-image. People asked Spud Webb, who is 5'4", how in the world he thought he could play in the NBA. How did Jim Abbott expect to play baseball, much less pitch in the major leagues, with one arm? How would he field the ball? Olympic gold medal winner Wilma Rudolph said she had to overcome a lot of fears and self-images to become a success. Her first challenge was to learn to walk without leg braces. Most of the work I do is as a stretch and not a shrink. I help athletes expand their comfort zone and encourage them to take risks. If you don't see yourself succeeding or you don't feel deserving, you will sabotage yourself. Be willing to take a risk. Remember, there is no security in life. There is only adventure. Limits begin where vision ends. Visualize success and give yourself permission to win. The fire inside. Each of us has a fire in our hearts for something. It's our goal in life to find it and keep it lit. Mary Lou Retton. All I want out of life is that when I walk down the street, folks will say, "There goes the greatest hitter who ever lived," Ted Williams. He remembers gazing into the night sky as a boy long, long ago. Each time he saw a falling star, he made a wish. "Please," he said, "let me be the hitter I want to be." As he grew older, his love for hitting a baseball didn't fade as many childhood infatuations do. The art form became his focus, his passion, his singular goal. "A man has to have goals for a day, for a lifetime," he said upon reflection. "Mine was to have people say, 'There goes Ted Williams, the greatest hitter who ever lived.'" On July 13, 1999, Major League Baseball staged its annual Midsummer Classic at Fenway Park in Boston. It was a glorious evening, perfect for stargazing. As part of the pregame festivities, the National and American League All-Star teams were introduced to the sellout crowd. So were the legends of the game. One by one, the announcer presented the members of baseball's All-Century team. Near the end of the roll call, a golf cart appeared in the old ballpark. Along with millions of other TV viewers, I watched as it slowly paraded around the field, its heroic passenger smiling, waving, greeted with warm cheers. Cameras flashed like winking stars, and when the announcer welcomed him and honored him, his voice was close to reverence. "That's Ted Williams, the greatest hitter who ever lived." Motivation is a popular word, especially in sports. It comes from a Latin word meaning to move. Athletes can move in one of two ways, either toward seeking pleasure or rewards, or toward avoiding pain or punishment. Motivation can be the desire to succeed or the fear of failure. I believe the best and healthiest motivation is the one that pushed Ted Williams, the last major leaguer to hit over 400 in one season, to reach his goal and live his dream. An athlete's success is said to depend upon four factors: physical ability, physical training, mental training, and desire or drive. The desire to succeed needs to be stronger than the fear of failure. You hear a lot of athletes who say they are motivated by a fear of failure, pitcher David Cone said. I couldn't disagree more. To me, it's an opportunity. This is what we live and play for. There's no place I'd rather be than right here, right now, pitching big games down the stretch for the Yankees. Muhammad Ali illustrates one of my favorite stories about motivation. When he was growing up in Louisville, he got a job sacking groceries. He didn't make much money, but he saved enough to buy a secondhand bicycle. He loved that blue bicycle. He was proud of it. He had worked hard for it and earned it. One day someone stole his bike. He was heartbroken. "I walked all over Louisville that summer looking for that bicycle," Ali said, picking up the narrative. "I walked and looked, looked and walked. Never found it to this day. But every time I got into the ring, I looked across at the other fighter and I told myself, 'Hey, that's the guy who stole my bicycle.'" Athletes find motivation in different ways. Roger Clemens said he thrived on the doubts that others had of him. The pitcher went into the 1997 season intent on proving the Red Sox had made a mistake by letting him go. The most successful athletes are self-motivated. The most important thing is to love your sport, said Peggy Fleming, the former Olympic figure skating champion. Never do it to please someone else. It has to be yours. That is all that will justify the hard work needed to achieve success. At a workshop with elite teenage athletes, I asked one young man to relate his most enjoyable sports experience. He recalled being 10 or 11 years old. He talked about how much fun he had shooting hoops. As the teen relived the memory, his father's eyes welled with tears. The young man who wanted to quit his high school team was still playing basketball for his father's sake. It was his dad's dream, not his own. What we associate with pleasure, we pursue. What we associate with pain, we avoid. Playing sports as a kid should be an enjoyable, positive, and rewarding experience. But too often, impressionable youngsters are embarrassed by a coach or they worry about pleasing their parents. Participating in sports then becomes a painful, even punishing experience. As a coach, I would want my kids to have fun. I would want them to be eager and excited. I would want them to feel they are improving and focusing on the process rather than the outcome. Motivation gets you moving in a direction. Being on a mission provides the emotion. Clemens was on a mission after he left the Red Sox. Arnold Schwarzenegger also had a mission. His vision created what he calls want power. Schwarzenegger said, "My wanting to be Mr. Universe came about because I saw myself so clearly, being up there on the stage and winning." Carl Lewis had an ambitious mission and a powerful vision, too. "I want to be remembered as a person who felt there was no limitation to what the human body and mind can do, and be the inspiration to lead people and do things they never hoped to do." At spring training, Alex Rodriguez designed T-shirts for himself and his Seattle Mariners teammates. The printed message read, "We're on a mission, sir." How about you? Does a fire burn inside you? Do you have a mission? What is it? What motivates you? If it is fear of failure, let that emotion go. The best motivation is want power, that prideful desire to achieve. Find your passion and make it happen. Be on a mission and live your life on purpose. Be motivated by your desire to achieve rather than your fear of failure. The 4 D's. Motivation gets you going. Discipline keeps you going. Jim Ryan. The only discipline that lasts is self-discipline. Bum Phillips. Several years ago, a Phoenix area school district conducted a survey of its high school athletes. The results confirmed growing rumors and suspicions. Of the students at 3 high schools who responded to the survey, more than 20% said they knew teammates or other athletes who were using steroids. The Paradise Valley District took quick action. Believing schools have an obligation to safeguard against the danger of drugs, the district instituted random drug testing of its high school athletes. The program made national news and sparked lively debate. Some people outside the district told administrators that drug testing might put district athletes at a competitive disadvantage. "They think because other schools use steroids, our athletes won't be able to compete without using them too," said Toby Spessard, a district administrator. "That logic is strange, to say the least. If our athletes have healthy minds and bodies and know they're going to compete fairly, I think that's an enormous advantage for us." At the time, I was team counselor for the NFL Cardinals. The school district asked if I would sit on a committee and develop a program to educate coaches and athletes about drugs and offer strategies to improve performance without the use of drugs, especially steroids. A sports medicine physician with the U.S. Olympic Committee conducted a study in which he asked young athletes this question: If a drug existed that would help you win an Olympic gold medal, but using it would take 5 years off your life, would you take it? More than half answered yes. Learning how to use one's mind can be as potent as any performance-enhancing drug. In medical studies, many patients report improvement in their physical condition after they are given placebos or sugar pills. Why? The power of the mind. I developed a mental skills training program for drug-free athletes called The Naturals. The night I outlined the program at a meeting with hundreds of high school athletes and their parents, I brought along two Cardinals players, Garth Jacks and Ron Wolfley. Someone said that people who have no fear either are in mental institutions or on special teams. Wolfley played on special teams for the Cardinals. He made all-pro running kamikaze missions, bolting downfield on punts and kickoffs, crashing full speed into oncoming opponents at great risk to his health and safety. As a player, he was fearless and tough and the most quotable player in the locker room. When I introduced Wolfley to the crowd, his message carried the same energy and passion with which he played the game. Ron spoke of a former NFL player he knew who took steroids and had become gravely ill. "I've seen steroids, and I'm telling you, I don't use any of that stuff," Wolfley proclaimed. "The only drugs I use are the four D's," and he ticked them off, one by one, his rising voice whip-cracking over the silent auditorium. Desire, dedication, determination, discipline. Those are the drugs I use, and I don't have to buy them on the street corner. They don't cost me anything. He pointed to his chest, to his heart. I've got them right here. Desire. We talked at great length about desire in the last section. Want power is as important as willpower when it comes to accomplishing your goals. What's your wish? What do you long for? Ted Williams found his singular desire at an early age. What's your dream? How badly do you want it? Dedication. Dedication is turning desire into action, which requires lasting commitment. Football coach Lou Holtz said, "If you don't make a total commitment to whatever you are doing, then you start looking to bail out the first time the boat starts leaking." Randy Johnson, the most dominating power pitcher of our time, says the most tragic event in his life, his father died on Christmas Day, 1992, proved to be the turning point of his career. "That was the year my heart became a lot bigger," Johnson said. "It's a matter of maturity, and it's a matter of my heart getting bigger, and it's a matter of dedicating myself to be the best." Determination. Everyone wants to be successful, but those who achieve success are steeled by an unwavering resolve. They are self-motivated, the kind of motivation that fueled and sustained Jack Nicklaus early in his pro career as he beat golf balls for an hour, then another, on the practice range until it was almost dark. "Let's go, Jack," his new wife Barbara called out impatiently. "I'm hungry." With calloused hands, Nicklaus hit another ball, then another, into the dying light. "So am I," Jack replied. Discipline. It means doing what you have to do when you need to do it, whether you want to or not. Self-discipline, the only kind that lasts, is action-oriented. It doesn't procrastinate, and it doesn't make excuses. "Setting a goal is not the main thing," said Tom Landry, the former Dallas Cowboys coach who is enshrined in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. "It's deciding how you will go about achieving it and staying with that plan. The key is discipline." Once you have your dream and direction, it is desire, dedication, determination, and discipline that keep you going. Ask yourself this: are you walking your talk? Part 3. Mindset for Success. Attitude is everything. I firmly believe that the only disability in life is a bad attitude. Scott Hamilton. A bad attitude is worse than a bad swing. Payne Stewart. Attitude is like a pair of eyeglasses. It is the lens through which we view the world. Positive-minded people see life around them through rose-tinted or clear glasses, while those who are negative squint through glasses that are dark and gloomy. Both types of people can look at the same event or situation and see it in two different lights. Attitudes influence how we act and feel. They also affect performance. Former Major Leaguer Dave Winfield said, "So many players enter the game with the same approximate skills. The difference is not aptitude, but attitude. Your attitude, more than your aptitude, determines your altitude, how high you go, how far you climb the ladder of success." Optimists have a positive expectancy that helps them achieve their goals. Theirs is a can-do attitude. They take action, which is empowering. Pessimists take a passive attitude. They play the blame game or focus on what they can't do. As a result, pessimists often become victims of self-fulfilling prophecy. Why would anyone not want to be an optimist? A Mayo Clinic study indicates that optimists, on average, live longer than pessimists do. The University of Pennsylvania tracked 120 men who had suffered one heart attack. After 8 years, researchers found that 80% of pessimists had died of a second attack, compared with 33% of optimists. Other research suggests optimism can lead to success at work, in school, and in sports. In his book, Learned Optimism, psychologist Martin Seligman studied the New York Mets and St. Louis Cardinals baseball teams. After interviewing managers and players, he predicted the Mets' success and the Cardinals' downfall the following year. Talent being equal, players with a positive, optimistic attitude will outperform those with a negative, pessimistic one. After the 1995 All-Star Game, I made my annual mid-season trip to Seattle to visit with the Mariners team. At the time, Tino Martinez, who had played in the All-Star Game, was struggling at the plate. I found him in the Kingdom taking batting practice. Tino looked relaxed and happy. Between cuts, he joked with Ken Griffey Jr. and other heavy hitters in the Mariners' lineup. Nearby, another player who recently had been called up from AAA, he had homered in his first at-bat with a big league club, was having no fun at all. Between pitches, he muttered to himself, and after each swing, he cursed the result. His body language said he was laboring, pressing. The kid looked as tense as strung wire. Afterward, I went into the manager's office and shared my observation with Lou Piniella. Tino and the other players provided an interesting study in contrast. "Mac," Piniella told me, "Tino is like I was when I played. When we struggle, we can't wait to get to the yard because we know we're due for a streak. A lot of younger guys who come up start questioning their ability, having doubts. Hitting is all about attitude." One day I was on a golf course practice green. I spotted Robin Yount, a member of baseball's Hall of Fame. Robin said he couldn't wait for his tee time. He was eager to get onto the course. "Are you playing well?" I asked, expecting him to say yes. "No, I've really been struggling," Yount replied. Then he shot me a smile. "But I know I'm due for a breakthrough." When I saw him in the parking lot several hours later, Robin said he had enjoyed a great round. While a positive attitude doesn't always work, a negative attitude almost always does. Since you don't know what's going to happen, why not act as if you're going to have a good day? If you don't want to believe in positive thinking, then just get rid of the negative thoughts. The Arizona Cardinals had just won a big game on the road. The players were laughing and joking in celebration throughout the long flight home. Much of their playfulness was directed at the flight attendants, who moved up and down the narrow aisle taking drink orders and serving dinner. As the plane rocked gently through the night sky, I remember smiling sympathetically at one harried flight attendant whose patience and cheerful disposition had been tested to the limit. As she walked past where I was seated, she rolled her eyes and muttered a self-reminding mantra of positive affirmation. I love my job. I love my job. I love my job. Attitudes are learned, beginning at a young age. The good news is that attitudes can be unlearned and changed. We can train ourselves to look positively at negative events. I once worked with a UCLA tennis player who hated tiebreakers. I never win tiebreakers, she told herself in a negative voice, so convincing that she came to believe it. But over time, she was able to change her attitude. She replaced that pessimistic voice with a positive one. I love tiebreakers. Tiebreakers bring out the best in me. We learned earlier that you can't outperform your self-image. If you haven't developed a positive frame of mind, you're not going to create the mental state that will help you physically perform at your best. There are three P's for changing pessimism into optimism. Permanence. Optimists believe that when they lose or experience setbacks, these disappointments are temporary rather than permanent. Pervasiveness. Unlike pessimists who let their doubts and troubles affect every area of their lives, optimists are able to put their problems in a box and not let them distract them. Personalization. Optimists internalize victories and externalize defeats. We played great today. We deserved to win. They were lucky tonight. We'll win tomorrow. The pessimist does just the opposite. We were lucky to win tonight. It's all my fault we lost. I'm a worthless loser. It is said that 10% of life is what happens to us, and 90% is how we choose to react to it. So let me ask you, what kind of attitude do you have? Are you an optimist? How do you view competition, winning, losing, adversity? How do you see yourself responding to pressure? Your attitude determines your altitude. If you think you can or can't, you're probably right. The choice is yours. Riding the pines. Attitude is a choice. Think positive thoughts daily. Believe in yourself. Pat Summitt. Don't let what you can't do interfere with what you can do. John Wooden. After starting 13 games the previous season and being voted by local sports writers as the team's most valuable player, Chris Chandler believed he deserved to be the Arizona Cardinals' starting quarterback. But when the 1993 season began, he found himself on the bench. Coach Joe Bugel had replaced Chandler with Steve Berline, a free agent who had signed a 3-year, $7.5 million contract. Bugel's decision wasn't surprising. In fact, it was almost as predictable as cafeteria food. The coach's job was on the line. He had to win. Also, in professional sports, money talks, and what it says is, play me. Hobbled in preseason by an ankle injury, even Chandler wasn't shocked by the move. But the demotion stung him nevertheless. It's a little embarrassing, he told the media, after the team announced the decision a week before the season opener. I know I'm not a backup, the new backup said, through gritted teeth. One day, early in the season, Chandler approached me as he walked off the field after practice. How do you handle something like this? He asked. As a sports psychology consultant, I devote much of my time counseling athletes who are sidelined because of a coach's decision or because they are injured. In this instance, I didn't know immediately how to respond. I wasn't sure what to say. I liked Chris. The Indianapolis Colts drafted him, then traded him in order to select Jeff George. Then Tampa Bay dumped him in mid-season. In my heart, I thought Chandler had earned the Cardinals' starting job and felt bad for him. I remembered a magazine article I had read about being your own boss. I told Chandler that even though he was a backup player, removed from the limelight, he still is a commodity on the National Football League Stock Exchange. Chris Chandler, Inc. Chandler needed to work each day on getting his stock to climb. Having a bad attitude wouldn't help. Not giving his best in practice only would drop his value. I reminded him that he was one play away from being the starter. He had to stay involved and ready. If the club traded him, what would he want the Cardinals' coaches and scouts to say about him? He has a good attitude. He works hard. He is coachable. He's a real team player. Chandler didn't play much that season. The next year, he went to Los Angeles and then on to Houston. Eventually, he found a home in Atlanta and led the Falcons to the Super Bowl. Good things come to those who stay optimistic and are willing to persevere. I tell minor league baseball players what I told Chandler. In AAA, half the players feel they belong in the major leagues. The others think they have nothing to prove at that level. I urge them to ink themselves. They are writing their career resumes with each performance. It's not easy sitting on the bench, riding the pines. It's doubly tough for athletes who are injured, even though injuries are a part of sports. An athlete can do nothing or use that time of inactivity wisely. Former Mariners pitcher Eric Hansen says spending more than 2 months on the disabled list proved to be one of his most valuable experiences in sports. "I didn't just sit around and wait for my arm to get better," Hansen said. "I saw a sports psychologist. At that time, I was just breaking in and was a little inconsistent. I had some good games and bad games, but I really didn't know the batters that well. I didn't know pitching that well, and I still don't. Every year is a learning process. I learned 10 times more from one night of not throwing a ball than I have my whole life pitching, all from observing, visualizing, and going through it mentally. I'd talk to Nolan Ryan for an hour at a time, to Roger Clemens, and to Mark Langston, who took me under his wing and was very inspirational. These are all guys who have been successful and who train hard, and all this was transpiring in the middle of the season during the time I couldn't pitch. I believe in can-do planning. When you're riding the pines, make a list of things you can do. Maybe that means watching videos, studying the opponent, exercising in the weight room, or cheering your teammates on. Ask yourself what factors you can control and what factors you can't. Many people carry a copy of the Serenity Prayer. The words are worth remembering. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It doesn't take talent to hustle and work hard. Invest in yourself with a positive attitude and can-do thinking. You gotta believe. The biggest thing is to have a mindset and a belief you can win every tournament going in. Tiger Woods. When you believe in yourself and the people you surround yourself with, you will win something really big someday. Dick Vermeil. During a practice round, Tiger Woods turned to friend Davis Love III and said wishfully, "Wouldn't it be nice if we could play head-to-head down the stretch?" 2 weeks later, competing in only his 5th professional tournament, Woods shot 8-under par 64 in the final round of the 1996 Las Vegas Invitational to finish in a tie for first place and force a sudden-death playoff. His opponent was Davis Love. After the tournament ended on the first extra hole, a television announcer congratulated the 20-year-old winner on his first PGA Tour victory and asked him if ever in his wildest dreams he imagined being so successful this early in his career. "I'll always remember Tiger's response." The 3-time U.S. amateur champion flashed his 1,000-watt grin and replied without hesitation, "Absolutely." Golf's newest sensation wasn't being cocky. Tiger was simply sharing the belief he has in himself. Belief is a state or habit of mind in which trust or confidence is placed in some person or thing. Beliefs drive behavior, and behaviors affect performance in everything we do. When Tiger turned pro and said he expects to win every time, a mindset he learned from Jack Nicklaus, PGA Tour veterans rolled their eyes. But it wasn't long before Woods opened those eyes to the power of his belief system. "You realize Tiger means it," Tom Lehman said. "How does that affect me? It changes my mindset. If I don't expect to win every time, how can I expect to compete? I need to learn what he's learned. I'd better trust in my talent. I'd better believe in myself under the gun. I'd better expect to win." In psychology, the term self-efficacy is the belief in one's own ability to be successful. Simply believing in yourself doesn't mean you're always going to win. But believing in yourself can help enable you to put yourself into a position to win. Dick Vermeil is one who believed in himself and his players. At 63, he coached the St. Louis Rams to a Super Bowl championship. Another coach, Penn State's Joe Paterno, said, "You've got to believe deep inside yourself that you're destined to do great things." One year, the New York Mets climbed from sixth place to win the National League pennant. "You gotta believe," pitcher Tug McGraw shouted during a clubhouse speech. His words became the motto the 73 Mets carried into the World Series. The University of Arkansas also enjoyed a successful run during that same era. One year, in celebration of a late-season victory that earned the Razorbacks an invitation to the Orange Bowl, happy Hog fans tossed oranges onto the field. The humor wasn't lost on Lou Holtz. "I'm glad," the Arkansas coach said after the game, "we're not going to the Gator Bowl." But the Razorbacks' giddiness gave way to gloom. In the Orange Bowl, Arkansas faced Oklahoma, the number two team in the nation. The Sooners had lost only one game and were coming off a 38-7 rout of Nebraska. Arkansas was a smaller team. Its All-America guard was sidelined with an injury. Also, Holtz benched his top three offensive players for disciplinary reasons. The media wrote Arkansas's obituary in advance. The Razorbacks, 24-point underdogs, had no chance. Sensing his players were beginning to believe what they read in the newspapers, Holtz called a team meeting 2 days before the game. He asked his players why they thought they could win. One by one, each stood in the company of teammates and offered a reason. One player cited the Razorbacks' staunch defense. Another reminded that the team's nucleus remained intact. As they spoke, sharing their faith in each other, the atmosphere in the room changed. Holtz privately told a friend that his team would score 38 points. He was overly optimistic, but not by much. Arkansas won 31-6. After the upset victory, a sports writer remarked how spirited the Razorbacks appeared when they sprinted out of the tunnel and onto the field before kickoff. It looked like a cavalry charge. What had Holtz said to them? "I told them that Oklahoma is big, mean, strong, nasty, and aggressive," Lou deadpanned. "And the last 11 guys out of the locker room are going to be the starters." Belief systems are a big part of confidence. Beliefs that are irrational or unrealistic lead to stress. Let's look at the ABC theory of success and stress. The A stands for the activating event. Tiger Woods enters the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. B is the belief about the event. Tiger tells himself, "I've retooled my game. I've worked hard. I know the course. I'm going to go out and have a good round." C stands for consequences, the feelings and behaviors about the outcome. Tiger says, "I felt confident. I played aggressively and smart." There are several unrealistic or irrational beliefs some athletes have about themselves. Some think they aren't big enough, strong enough, fast enough, or good enough to play at a certain level. My question to them is, where's the evidence? Some have a belief system that says failure is a shameful thing. In truth, life is based upon failures. If you don't fail, you're probably not challenging yourself enough. If, as babies, we had a fear of failure, if we believed that failure is terrible, we might never learn to walk. Another irrational belief is, if I mess up, no one will love me. I'll be rejected. Imagine the pressure that kind of thinking creates. If you believe that by not winning, you're a loser, if you believe that if you lose, no one will love you, if you believe that taking a risk is dangerous, if you believe that not being perfect is unacceptable, these beliefs will only cause upset and trouble in your life. One way some athletes counter irrational beliefs is through positive affirmations. These affirmations should be powerful, positive, and in the present tense. Muhammad Ali was the master. It's a lack of faith that makes people afraid of meeting challenges, and I believe in myself, Ali said. Also, to be a great champion, you must believe you are the best. If you're not, pretend you are. With a smile in his voice, the former heavyweight champion and boxing's greatest showman told himself and the world, "I'm so bad, I make medicine sick." Ali proclaimed that there were only two greats in the world, Britain and me. Rod Carew, one of baseball's finest hitters, asked, "Do you believe you're a starter or a bench warmer? Do you believe you're an all-star or an also-ran?" If the answer to these questions is the latter, your play on the field will reflect it. But when you learn to shut off outside influences and believe in yourself, there is no telling how good a player you can be. In the cartoon strip, Dennis the Menace asks Santa Claus, "Do you believe in yourself?" Ask yourself that question. What is your belief system? Do you believe in your dreams, your goals, and your abilities? Remember, what your mind can conceive and your heart believe, you can achieve. Beliefs drive behaviors, and self-limiting beliefs lead to self-defeating behaviors. Believe in yourself and your abilities. Between the ears. What you are thinking, what shape your mind is what makes the biggest difference of all. Willie Mays. Competitive golf is played mainly on a 5.5-inch course. The space between your ears. Bobby Jones. Oftentimes, an athlete will go into a performance nosedive. In sports psychology, one means of investigating what happened and why is to retrieve the equivalent of the black box and voice recorder. I slid the video into the slot and pressed the play button. The major league pitcher seated in my office recognized the figure on the big screen TV. It was himself. As he stood on the mound and delivered a warm-up pitch, then another, the sights, sounds, feelings, and emotions of that unpleasant day began coming back to him. On the screen, the leadoff batter stepped lightly into the box. Settling in, bat waving back and forth, he turned his eyes toward the figure 60 feet 6 inches away. I then asked the pitcher what he was thinking at that moment, just before the game began. "I didn't have very good stuff in warm-ups," he began. "I was thinking, I hope I don't walk this guy." "What else?" As he spoke, I almost could hear the dread rising in his voice, like water in a flooding basement. "He's really quick. If he gets on, he'll probably take second. Our catcher's arm's not that great. If he steals second, there's a good chance they'll score,